To pursue this work, Valley Group field agents search the western states for the finest recovery speakers to come and share their message of experience, strength, and hope with us. Each week, a single speaker is chosen from the many for their first service to the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. And now Valley Group World Headquarters is proud to announce the winner of the Outstanding Speaker of the Week. The nominee for this category has a sobriety date of 5/22/93. He has been in continuous service to the Fellowship as a secretary, a sponsor, and an H&I coordinator who for the past 18 years has taken meetings into various penitentiaries around the state of California. His AA motto is, "Where's God in all that?" May I have the envelope, please? The winner of the Outstanding Speaker of the Week, it's Marty S. from Fresno.
My name is Marty, and I'm a grateful alcoholic. And if being a grateful alcoholic makes some people uncomfortable, I'm glad. Because I was not a grateful alcoholic when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. I wasn't a grateful alcoholic when I started to introduce myself as a grateful alcoholic. But I introduced myself as a grateful alcoholic because at 6 years sober, my sponsor told me to. And I had been in the center of the pack in Alcoholics Anonymous early on, and I spent a lot of time with my sponsor. And at his kitchen table one day, he said I was getting a reputation in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I thought, finally, they know who I am. And he said, not a reputation you want. And he was a little old man. And he said if he was ever in a meeting with me and heard me not introduce myself as a grateful alcoholic, he was going to kick my you-know-what. And for that fleeting second, I thought he might, and I've done it ever since. I did some experimentations with other substances and alcohol. I overdosed at 12. Every time I did other substances, I grew up near the Russian River in Sonoma County, and the hippies were coming out of San Francisco, and there was every kind of chemical available. Most of my seventh grade class was doing acid and psychedelics. But every time I did a substance other than alcohol, I overshot the mark. And when I got to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, that I said for years, I was 33 years old, and somebody has corrected me of late, I was actually 34 years old. I have one sobriety date. I got here and I stayed here. I am an alcoholic as what's described in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. I want to welcome all of our newcomers and our gentlemen here with one day. I pray that you keep coming back and you find here what I found here. I really do. I'm going to talk about sort of the end of my drinking quickly to qualify. When I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I hated God. And I didn't just hate God. I beyond hated God. And I had some major events take place in my life, and God had pretty much ruined my life. I walked into my first meeting. I was 12-step, and there on the wall, God and all those steps, and people were talking about God, and I about bolted out of that meeting. When I was 17 years old, I had long periods of time I was drinking every day, long periods of time when I drank as a periodic. From the time I was 16 years old, I was drinking every morning on the way to school. At 17 years old, I had left. I grew up in Santa Rosa. I had done, which I didn't know then, I was in the process of doing my first geographical over a girl. Made that decision while drinking a half a pint of vodka every morning that I needed to follow her to Fresno. So I quit school, got an equivalency, and followed her to Fresno. I'm from a close family. And at 17 years old, my parents were killed, and how I found out is I saw it on national TV. And I didn't grow up in a household where there was any God or any religion, and I was pretty well convinced that the God was out to get me. And at 22 years old, I caught a form of meningitis, and as a result of that, I've had a number of brain surgeries. At that point, I was absolutely convinced that God was out to screw up my life. I became very angry. I became very violent. I became very, very, very antisocial. And I continued that behavior until my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. Well, really, I continued that behavior into Alcoholics Anonymous. I spent 2 years prior to getting to Alcoholics Anonymous trying to control my drinking. I know I drank. I don't recall if I got drunk. I was hanging out with a woman who later became my second wife, and she would tell people that we worked hard and we played hard. I was riding motorcycles with a group of very socially unacceptable individuals. All the chaos and the craziness, we thrived on that. I loved that. And then that's what I was like when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous. I arrived in my first meeting, riding my Harley in a black t-shirt, boots, and beat up and done, and I didn't know what I was done doing. So I went through that 2 years. I don't recall getting drunk. In the last 6 months before I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I started to drink again. And when I read in the big book, The Progression of Alcoholism, I knew exactly what they were talking about. And that last 6 months contained events. We got married in a third world country. We were detained coming out of that third world country over an all-natural herbal substance. And don't forget, I didn't do all-natural herbal substances. I drank. I got a front row seat to lower companionship. When I ended up at Alcoholics Anonymous, it was just a couple of weeks after my 34th birthday. We had been married a little over 3 months and a few days. That last night of drinking, she left. I went on a violent rampage. That lasted many hours. I drank a fifth of whiskey. Didn't get drunk, but I did pass out. I didn't normally pass out. When I came to that morning, I was not prone to suicidal thoughts. I was really more prone to homicidal thoughts. I sat up in bed and looked at what the inside of our house looked like. And it was beyond the pictures we would see of Afghanistan or Baghdad. There was a note on the bottom of the bed that she wasn't going to live that way anymore, and she was all that was left. And I sat up in bed, and the only thought I had was, if something doesn't change, I'm going to blow my brains out. I had been in and out of mental health professionals' offices since I was 17 years old. I don't recall talking about my drinking. If I did, I'm sure that I lied. One more time to appease her, I was seeing some kind of shrink or therapist in this group therapy thing. There was a woman in there who asked me out to lunch, and I'm sure that she wanted to talk about things other than what was going on in that therapy group. So I went out to lunch with her, and she made a comment at lunch. She said, I wish Bruce, her husband, could be there. He's so wise. When I came to that morning, I didn't know what to do. She was gone. I was beside myself. And for some reason, I picked up the phone and called that woman. And I asked her if I could talk to Bruce. And I had no Bruce. I didn't know anything about AA. I'd never been court-ordered AA. The only thing I knew about AA, if you're old enough, was the scenes they used to have on Hill Street Blues. Bruce met me in In-N-Out Burger in Highway City, sort of on the west side of Fresno by Highway 99. We sat at In-N-Out Burger before they opened in those hard plastic seats outside. And I one more time wanted somebody just to agree that she deserved what I had done to her the night before. And I started crying, and I don't come from a world where you cry. And today I know where the words came from. I said, I haven't done this drinking in a long time. Maybe I'm an alcoholic. And he left me sitting there, and he ran to his car, and he came, popped the trunk, and he came back. I just met this guy. I didn't know anything about this guy. And he set this book down in front of me, this big book. It was the third edition. He opened it to page 449, and he said, read this. And he says, nothing, absolutely nothing happens in God's will by mistake. And acceptance is the answer to all my problems today. And then I started to bawl. because I knew that I had no acceptance for anything in my life. And then he proceeded to start to talk to me about Alcoholics Anonymous and his and what he was like as an alcoholic. And so I don't know how long we sat there. He gave me his book, gave me his card, gave me his schedule, and there was a men's meeting in Clovis, which my two friends, Shane and Bruce, announced through our fellowship. So on the 22nd of May, 1993, at 1 o'clock in the afternoon, about 1:50 in the afternoon, I rode my motorcycle up to that meeting, and there was a whole bunch of Harleys parked in front. I backed in between them. The meeting had started. I walked in. There was a seat back in the corner, and it was like walking into the bar of Star Wars. There was a guy at the table with no face and a black eye patch, and some of you may or may not know Matt G sitting there at the table. Some of you may be sober enough, long enough to remember Prison Jerry sitting at the table, Crazy Frank sitting at the table, and it was like I really thought I'd walked in the bar at Star Wars. And I sit down in the back. And a man named Daryl W. sitting in front of me, and he's got a greasy, stringy beard and gray hair and a ponytail stretched down the back of his jacket, a cut-off vest, a bunch of motorcycle tattoos. He's the kind of person I was running around with. He brought me half a cup of coffee and tried to give me a hug, and I didn't want to be touched, and he whispered in my ear that it was going to be okay. And in spite of me, it's been okay. It's not always been fun, but in spite of me, it's been okay. And at that meeting, they're talking about, you know, they're introducing themselves, you know, my name's so-and-so and I'm an alcoholic, and my name's so-and-so and I'm an alcoholic, and I'm a quick study, and the last guy they called on was me. And I stood up and said, my name's Marty, I'm an alcoholic. And for the first time ever, I talked about what I had done the 24 hours prior. And I finished, and they said, keep coming back. And I hadn't been invited back anywhere in a long time. You know, and I was in business for myself. I had a partner. He hadn't wanted anything to do with me for a long time. If he could have killed me, I think that would have made his life easier. I was absolutely antisocial and couldn't control my emotions, behavior, anything. The meeting ended, and another guy with a lot of time came, and he put his arm around my shoulder, and he said, I never lived in a house without plywood on the windows until I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I knew what he was talking about. And he started having me reading the sayings on the wall, first things first, think, 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 and they told me I probably wasn't qualified for think, 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 easy does it, and I don't know how long after that meeting, but those men surrounded me. And they said, keep coming back, and they got my phone number. They handed me a list and went around that room. What I didn't know then that I know now is the magic of Alcoholics Anonymous that started to work in my life. Bruce, who 12-stepped me, I called him when I was done. He said, call me after the meeting. He says, why don't you come over and have dinner with Linda and I, his wife. And then Linda said, let me go back and try to help you do something with that house. And we picked up the house, stacked up all the doors, we ripped off the hinges, there's holes in the walls, I had thrown a file cabinet through a wall, well, until it hit the studs. I had broken my knuckles for the second time in 90 days when I punched a refrigerator. I had taken a butcher knife to everything that she owned, including her clothes and furniture. Her father was sober a number of years in the South, and she had one thing of her father's, and I had thrown that stereo across the room to teach her a lesson, and I understand the power of her resentment today. So I left that meeting, and I became a project of the old-timers in Alcoholics Anonymous. So the following weekend, that men's group had the camp out every other, twice a year, and that was going to be the spring camp out. That was the following week. Some guys had called me, and I wanted to go on that camp out. And I was scared. So I called. I wanted to ride my motorcycle, so I knew Daryl Rose. So I called Daryl, and Daryl said, yeah, I'll meet you. We met a meeting place on Saturday morning. And I'm a guy that I don't own a sleeping bag. I don't own a tent. I don't own a cook stove. I don't have time to camp. And he said, don't worry about it. Just come. And he met me, and we rode up there, and I was like his shadow all weekend. And I met and started to come close to a bunch of guys in Alcoholics Anonymous. And we came back from that camp out, and they would call me and say, we're going here, we're meeting for coffee first, be there. They wouldn't ask, be there. We're going to this meeting, be there. And I did my first H&I commitment. I was 30 days sober. They told me to meet them at 3 o'clock on a Saturday at Juvenile Hall. They said, you're going to do H&I. I said, what's H&I? I said, it doesn't matter. Just be there. And I show up at Juvenile Hall. I'm like 30 days sober. I go in with this crazy guy named Alaska Joe. And I got blue jeans, motorcycle boots, a black T-shirt, and a rag on my head. And I go into Juvenile Hall. All those kids want to know is that I ride a Harley. I don't know if any of those kids are still sober, but here I stand almost 20 years later. That's what I know. I don't know what kind of message I had. They told me, you're here 30 days. Those kids don't have 30 days. Talk about what it's like to have 30 days in Alcoholics Anonymous. And it started me on a journey. And I asked Bruce, the man who 12-stepped me. I was going to meetings with him, and we'd go have coffee. And we'd go have coffee after the meetings. We'd go to a 7 a.m. meeting, and we'd sit and talk. And he said, well, we'd say, what step you on? And I'd ask him these really intelligent questions. So one day I said, well, I'm on the third step. So what the hell does this mean? Made a decision, turned my will and my life over the care of God as I understood him. Does that mean I get up, make a pot of coffee, sit on the couch, light a cigarette, and God's going to strike me with lightning and tell me what to do today? And he said, just keep coming back. And that's what I've done. So as I started on this journey of sobriety, and I hated God, and I was sure when I was in this men's meeting, and that became my home group, that were everybody an alcoholic. And you looked around this room, and I'm in this room with guys that I was in a meeting when he had one more day of his adult life out of the penitentiary than he did in the penitentiary. I'm sure that the fourth and fifth step is where these guys chip. That all looks good on the wall, but nobody does the fourth and fifth step around here, not this group. I run around with people like you guys. And I had this conflict with God. I hated God. And I had proof. I was different than all of you. God was responsible for everything that was wrong in my life. And I can prove it. I was leaving that first meeting, and Prison Jerry came up to me, and Prison Jerry was a great big guy. He said, go home and pray. I said, no. He says, go home and pray. I said, no. He says, go home and pray. I said, no. You gotta understand, Prison Jerry's towering over me. He's about 4 years sober, has his big Fu Manchu, and he's covered head to toe with prison tattoos. He's a little bit scary. And I said, no. And he looked me in the eye and said, what the hell do you got to lose? I didn't think so. I went home, and the following morning, I tried some kind of feeble prayer. Now, I was absolutely convinced that was going to make no difference in my life. But I did it because I didn't have anything to lose. I had zero expectations that would work great for all of you guys, but I had proof. So I'm running around, they're dragging me places, they're dragging me to meetings, they're dragging me to coffee, they're dragging me to fellowship. These guys are talking about steps, these guys are talking about sponsors, these guys are talking about praying in the morning, these guys are talking about meditating, and I'm like, whatever. But I just started to do it because everybody was doing it. And I'm out with these guys, and I don't have, the people that I was riding motorcycles with had kicked me to the curb 8 or 9 months before I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. And there was nobody left. So I'm just doing it because these guys are doing it, and they're calling me, and they're inviting me places. I think most of them should be committed. But I'm hanging out with them because there's nobody else to hang out with. And I'm going to tell you that for the most part, every day since that first meeting, I spent some time in some kind of prayer in the morning, knowing full well it's not going to work for me. So I asked Bruce, the man at 12-step me, to take me through the steps, and we started on a journey. We started through the big book, and we started through the steps, and I did a fourth and a fifth. And I'm not going to stand here and tell you that I did the best that I could. All I know today is I did enough, just enough, to get me to the point I needed to do more. And I'm having trouble with God. And all these things are happening in my life, and I'm not willing of connecting the dots. So early on, a friend of mine, we got sober together, likes to tease me that he was going to those morning meetings. People wouldn't sit within 3 seats of me. I mean, I was angry. So there was a man in those morning meetings. He used to sit off in the corner, and you know, presidents like Visalia, you don't see a lot of people in three-piece suits, all the silver hair, everything's perfectly in place. He looks like a TV preacher. I couldn't sit still through an hour meeting. I was outside angry, puffing on a cigarette, walking back, pacing in front of the meeting. And he walks out and he says, "Marty, you look troubled." And I start off on everything that's wrong with my life. He says, "Why don't you give me a call?" And he hands me his card and he walks off. There was a little fishing on his card. And little fishies and I did not cross paths. And I got nutted up enough where I knew if I didn't do something, I might drink. And I called him. And he was a therapist. I'm thinking he's turning for clients in Alcoholics Anonymous. So when I've been around long enough, you don't do that. So some period of time, I stepped in my wallet. I got nutted up enough. I called him. He says, "My God, my appointment just canceled. Come by my office." And he looks like he sits on a mountaintop, and I go by his office, and he's got this big couch, and he's sitting in this chair with his legs crossed, and I'm MFing God. And because, you know, I'm MFing God. And I'm raging at God in his office. And I did that a number of times in his office. And part of it was I was trying to rile him, because the story was he was a former monk. And he likes to share that he found a German order that drank beer with every meal. And this is all within my first year. So I'm over in his office one day, and I'm MFing God, and I'm wearing myself out. I'm spinning in circles. I'm falling on his couch. And he's saying, "That's beautiful." And I get up, "What's the effing beautiful about this and that?" And I'm spinning in circles, MFing God, and then I sort of collapse on his couch. He said, "Marty, that's wonderful." Trying to turn around and say, "You know, what's the effing wonderful about this?" And he says, "To be that angry at something, you got to be having a relationship." Now, I have a college degree, but I am not the quickest study. And that made no sense to me at all. It didn't make sense to me until years later. So, meanwhile, I'm still spending time with God in the morning, and I'm working on the steps, and I'm working on the steps, and I'm pissed. I mean, you took my parents. You didn't just take my parents. You took them in front of me. And I'm beyond pissed. And I'm working the steps, and so there's all this stuff going around all of this. So I do a lot of men's meetings. I'm a men's meeting guy. My sponsor started a men's meeting, Rule 62 in Fresno. So Phil started that meeting, and they talk about God in there, and I would stand up. I'd get so angry, I would MF the meeting. I would stomp out of there and slam the door. And my famous line, everybody likes to still tease me about, but there's two damn pages of my book stuck together, the rest of you MFs get to read. And I'd slam the door, and then we'd go, "Keep coming back." And this is not, and I'm not talking 1 year, and I'm talking 3, 4, and 5 years. But some things happened to me. I brought some behaviors into Alcoholics Anonymous that are less than extraordinary. I brought some business practices into Alcoholics Anonymous that are not good. I left some items out of that fourth and fifth step. So to frame all this, when I took my 1 year chip, I was well into my 9-step amends. At least the amends is the stuff I talked about on my inventory. So I left a little matter out about a former wife, a new husband, and some kids that I had adopted that I convinced them that would be in their best interest that he adopted them for me so I'd have to pay child support. And I wasn't paying her any money. And I wasn't telling the sponsor about that because I'm sure I would have to do something. So at about 18 months, I changed sponsors to Phil, who had 36 years when he passed away in December. So Phil was my sponsor for 18 years. And I spent hours and hours and hours and hours early on with Phil. And I'm the same age as Phil's children. and I got more of Phil's time than Phil's children got. So I sort of explained it to Phil with the Marty spin. He asked me some questions. What does he do? And I told him, he said, they need the money. And I said, I don't think so. He said, well, forget it. Said, well, shit, that's easy. What's this all about? And then at 2.5 or 3 years, I'm going through a divorce to that woman who left me that night. I was ignored all the suggestions in Alcoholics Anonymous. Let her go, get sober, let God be in charge. No, God's not being in charge. I don't need to get sober. I know what's best for me. And I managed to convince her to come back. And I had a very painful, drama-filled divorce in 3 years. So I was going through that divorce, and I was sitting at Phil's kitchen table. Phil said, what about my step? Do you have any amends? Do you have any? I said, no, I'm done with everything that was on that list. He says, what about that woman? The first wife and those kids. I said, well, we talked about that. You said, forget it. He said, that was then. This is now. And I wrote an amends. And I sat on Phil's kitchen table. And she and her husband were physically scared of me, and they should have been. And the children didn't want any, I'm pretty sure didn't want anything to do with me. And he helped me write a letter to her, and asking her to meet me in a public place at a given time. And the letter started, I'm not very good at writing. He wrote it, and I put it in my own handwriting, that I want to talk to you about my part in our marriage. And the really thing that floored me was, I never had a part in our marriage. It was all her fault. And I put it in the mail. And I went and sat in that location for an hour and a half or 2 hours, and she didn't show up. And I called Phil. And Phil said, you go home, and every day when you're praying, because I'm still praying, but I don't have zero expectations that my life's going to change. Meanwhile, it's all getting better around me. I just don't see it. Is for the willingness to make that amends. And one night I was cooking dinner. I remember how long afterwards she called me. And I very rarely told Phil no. When Phil told me to do something, I did it. And Phil told me to write her a check. We calculated out about how much I estimated I would have owed in child support. You know, I told Phil no. And he looked at me, his mouth dropped open. And I had learned a few things about amends. And I had learned, if I don't feel some pain, I may not learn the lesson. And business was really good. And he looked at me when I said no. And he was floored. I said, I'm not going to do that. I'm going to write a check for the full amount. And she called. So one night, sometime after, I was cooking dinner, and she called. And I got to make the amends. She was not receptive to the amends. Talked about sending her the money. In her case, she didn't want the money, which is irrelevant to the story. But I was willing to do that. And I hung up the phone. And I felt nothing. Virtually every amends I'd ever made, I felt a huge sense of relief. And I had, in my case, all of my family relationships were restored. I had some business relations. I had some things that people weren't necessarily fond of me, but I was not thrown out. Somebody at least were receptive to listen to me. And she's like, have a great life. Click. And the next day I went to a new meeting, and they were talking about a nice step. And I got to talk about it. And I felt a little something. Something inside of me cracked. I don't know, 6 years sober, maybe 7 years sober. So I sponsored a man who's just took a 15-year chip. And in his first year, his business got raided by the federal government, guns drawn. They confiscated his computers, all his business records. I have less. I'm practicing less than ethical business practices. I have been investigated. I've been investigated by the federal government. They looked in the wrong place. That scared me. And I was in my fifth year of sobriety. I hadn't been doing it for some short period of time because I got scared when I was investigated, and I knocked it off. him, but I still didn't share that with the sponsor. And I still hate God. I hate God. And so he and I are having lunch. We're talking about all this. I said, well, the federal government's prosecuting him. He's going to the pen. So he's the first guy I shared actually what my business practices were with, because I figured I could share it with him. It's not going anywhere. And just so you know, he and I no longer sponsor him, but he is my closest friend. And so I carried that around with me for 5 years sober until, 2001, I was 8 years sober. I moved back to the Bay Area where I'd grown up. I learned a few things in AA. I went up before I moved. I got hooked up. I found meetings. I got connected to Do H&I. I started taking meetings in the San Quentin. And I'm a member of the fellowship. I'm in the center of the pack. And I got myself in the center of the pack in the San Francisco Bay Area, just like I am in Fresno. So I'd come back to Fresno and work a little bit, and when I got real busy, I would take an apartment from Phil, because he was an apartment manager, and he said it was 11 years, I think it was 10 years, but somewhere between 10 and 11, I'm not feeling a part of Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, my Alcoholics Anonymous life is, I have three commitment meetings a week, I go to at least those three commitment meetings, all those commitment meetings have fellowship before or after, I'm doing H&I, I'm hanging out, I talk to two or three alcoholics every day. I'm taking meetings once a month in the San Quentin. I'm taking meetings once a month in McGuire Jail in Redwood City. I got a lot of friends in AA, but my insides are not matching everybody's outsides, and I am miserable. So I'm down here in my apartment at Phil's, and Phil and I was really close to Phil. We have coffee every morning. We both get up early. I show up at his door between 5 and 5:30. So I come in late one night. I'd been out to a meeting and dinner with my buddies, and I'm not okay. And something possessed me to go on the Internet. And, you know, thank God for the Internet. I was able to calculate or roughly estimate how much money I had stolen. And I was roughly able to track who I stole it from. And this today I know is all about divine intervention. I'm not sure why I'm doing this. And I took my big book, and I started reading about making amends. And I didn't sleep all night. I prayed, not expecting anything to happen, but I learned in AA, you pray. You know, what the hell's you gonna do? Pray or drink. And I show up at Phil's at 5:30 in the morning, and he says, "You look like shit because I haven't slept." And I said, "I need to talk to you." He says, "Well, come in, the coffee's on." And I sat on his kitchen table. And that morning, I completed my fifth step. 10 and a half years sober. I told him precisely who I'd stolen from, precisely how much money. And in the last line or last two lines, what I told him before I shut up to listen to him, I'm absolutely willing to go back to those people and take it on the chin. And these were federal crimes. I am absolutely willing to go to the federal penitentiary to make this right. And he says, like he would say to me, "Stebbin, you never cease to amaze me." And he gave me a list of things to do. He said, "Don't do anything until we talk again." And he gave me a list of things to do. So when I moved back to the Bay Area, I had became acquainted with the religion that I grew up with, that I never had any background with a little bit, and I'd gotten to know, I'm Jewish, I'd gotten to know a rabbi, and so Phil sent me out to talk to a close friend of mine in Fresno, who was a criminal offense attorney, and talk to the rabbi and tell him absolutely the truth, and no sugarcoating it, tell him the truth. And I went out and I did that. And he said, "Then ask them what they would advise you to do." And he said, "Then come back and see me. Don't do anything." And I went back and sat at his kitchen table a week or 10 days later, told him reported back what they said. He concurred. And both of them agreed that nothing would be gained from me going to prison. I had learned my lesson, but the money absolutely had to be repaid. It was physically impossible to pay it to the people that I had stolen from, so I needed to pay it to something around what the crime involved. And we're not talking a little bit of money, we're talking a lot of money. And I came back and reported that to Phil. Phil agreed with that, and I started to repay the money. And I'm coming up on my 20th birthday. It is not repaid, but it's almost all repaid. And then Phil knew me, and then Phil told me that I had to do this anonymously. I could not write this off on my taxes. And I will say that I have every single cashier's check that I ever mailed, because if I'm ever there investigated, I mean, I need that information. But something unexpected happened to me. And if you're new or fairly new, there's a saying in Alcoholics Anonymous, I don't hear it much anymore, but we're only as sick as our secrets. And I used to sit in meetings thinking, I'm glad I don't have any secrets. Phil used to tell me all the time I was delusional. And I wish he was still here, because I thought he's absolutely right. My relationship with God changed. My relationship with God changed. It's been different from the moment I left Phil's house with the path to the amends for that thing. And it's just different. I still argue with God. I'm still mad with God. Sometimes I understand exactly what that former monk said to me, and it's okay. And all I did was, one day at a time, I kept coming back, and I didn't take a drink. And I got just a couple of minutes left, I want to talk about one of the greatest gifts that I've gotten in Alcoholics Anonymous, and that's to be invited into the end of someone's life. We've had a hell of a year in Alcoholics Anonymous in Fresno with people dying. So I came back to Fresno in 2008 when the stock market, I was sort of semi-retired, and the stock market sold off. I lost everything. Everything. And I came back to Fresno to go back to work, because that's what Alcoholics Anonymous taught me to do, because I owe money. And I don't know why that I'm back here, but I had a very, very, very close friend in Alcoholics Anonymous that took 7 years off from Alcoholics Anonymous, and by the grace of God, he didn't drink. And when he was gone, he got cancer. And I'm back in Fresno. I'm in the market behind a mutual friend of ours, and he said, have you talked to Joe? I said, no. He said, Joe's dying. So I called Joe. You make that cursory thing, you know, let's go have lunch, like, you know, just because of what you're supposed to say. I completely lost touch with Joe. He became better than, he gained success, he gained money, he became someone, and didn't need Alcoholics Anonymous. He came back, and he showed up at a meeting, and he called me the following Monday. He said, I can't go to lunch, I got chemo, and then he said, but I really want to go to lunch, and I knew then he was sincere. That Thursday night, he showed up at Route 62, and he was back. And I was involved with a woman when I came back in San Francisco, so I had this long-distance relationship for a number of years. So we invited him and his wife up to San Francisco for the weekend. And he rode motorcycles, and we rode motorcycles together, and he rode with sort of some outlaws in Chicago, and we both sober rode like we did when we were outlaws. And we had fun. So he's in San Francisco now, he's dying. We take a walk to Chinatown, we sit down on this bench on this Sunday morning, and he said to me, he said, I don't like my legacy, and I'm dying. He said, I've watched you since you got sober. I like what you do. How do you do it? And I got to tell him precisely how I get newcomers, how I do H&I. And it was absolute, it had a front row seat for him to get reengaged in Alcoholics Anonymous. He got a sponsor. He went through the steps again. He started sponsoring a guy. When he passed, I think he was sponsoring 12 or 13 guys. He signed up. He went with me every month to the penitentiary, sick or not sick. And you got to walk when you get there. When you come to the sally port, you got to walk to the yards. And I had the privilege and the honor of being with him and his wife in the hospital when they told him he had just a few weeks left. And what an honor that is for a guy like me, because that's not what I signed up for in Alcoholics Anonymous. And really quickly, Phil passed away the 28th of December, and Phil had a 3-year struggle with cancer. In the last year of his life, they told him he had 30 to 60 days to live, so we came back to his house. He has no family. His biggest fear was dying, was what was I going to do, because he didn't have any money. And we rallied the troops in Alcoholics Anonymous. We thought it was going to be for 90 days. And hospice said, this is never going to last. somebody from Alcoholics Anonymous was in his house 24/7 for 13 months. And what happened to that relationship inside that house? People that never knew anybody became close. People that had long-standing resentments dropped those resentments. And Phil took a turn and he got better, where he was getting out of bed and he was coming in and he was watching TV and he would engage. And I stepped back because I had Phil at that point for 18 years or 17 years, and these were new guys in Phil's life. And I got to watch Phil's magic with new guys. And Phil's three boys were with him when he passed. The three boys that he had a marginal relationship with were with him when he passed. And all they could talk about was wow, Alcoholics Anonymous, and wow to be there with their dad. And I'm going to close with a line that I stole from a man I went into San Quentin with, is I really am a satisfied customer. Thank you.
Thank you, Marty.